Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people. A regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics. Brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds, the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in rainy Berkeley, California today. Bob is off on assignment. We'll be back very soon. But I'm excited to be talking about a topic that I've been wanting to have as a show for a while, which is around this new project that's around non-cooperation and non-compliance. It's a project that's being promoted, trained, run by a group called the Freedom Trainers. And joining me today is one of the trainers and one of the organizers of this project, Nadine Block. Nadine is an old friend of mine. I think the very first mass action I ever went to, I met Nadine at an IMF World Bank protest in like 2002, and you were handing me a flyer on the street. But Nadine is an activist, an artist, a puppetista, and a strategic nonviolence trainer and organizer. Works at the intersection of arts, culture, and people power. You can find Nadine in Beautiful Trouble, Creative Beautiful Rising, We Are Many, Reflections on the Movement Strategy from Occupation to Liberation, many other places. She's also, you also publish regularly in Waging Nonviolence, I believe, which is a pretty popular website, and then is also currently working with the Freedom Trainers. Nadine, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Hey, Scott, great to be here. Thanks for the warm welcome.
Yeah.
And great to know you remind me where we first met.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I was a young, up-and-coming little activist back then. Maybe we can just start off because we're in a sort of dire moment in American history. And you have been a longtime organizer and trainer with a, you have broad and deep experience. You also live in Washington, D.C. But maybe just to kick off, how do you view this moment that we're experiencing right now, and how do you think we should be approaching it?
Yeah, absolutely, Scott. I think it's really important in this moment, as someone who's done this work for about four decades, I have to admit, the work of fighting austerity and measures and fighting authoritarians globally. So my work both with the Beautiful Trouble crew and many other folks around the world includes supporting activists in Myanmar, supporting activists in Nicaragua, all over the world who are fighting authoritarians, which is a good place to start by saying we're in the midst of a two-decade or so slide into authoritarianism globally. It is true that democracies are fairly stable. Very few of them go away in any particular year, but once they start to slide, it's often fatal. And we in the United States, one could note that we have a long history of authoritarianism here, and authoritarianism as far as you racialized authoritarianism in the global South. Our country was founded and utilized slavery, the enslavement of other humans. We are based in a lot of patriarchal misogyny, racism, white supremacy, and this is something that we've seen in many ways. So we're not in a situation where it's new to us, although not everyone in the US will have experienced it directly or understand it that way. And we are also in a moment where the consolidation in the United States is happening at a rate that's extremely fast, faster than most other places in the world. When I say consolidation, the effort of the authoritarian or the dictator, whatever term you want to use, to make sure that their power becomes the rule of the law and to get rid of other potential challenges. And people are talking about it as competitive authoritarianism, this capitalist authoritarianism, if you will, where you still have elections, but they don't really count, or techno-feudalism. Another unique feature of where we are now in the world is that we have never before seen such state capture of our data and our digital footprint and the control of media, which is a unique feature of right now, the authoritarian rise. But we do see in the United States a very, as we call it, a robust authoritarian playbook being enacted here.
And when we're talking about this authoritarian playbook, and a lot of this is based on Project 2025, which the Russell Vought, who's the director of the Office of Management and Budget, he penned it. He also, it's also coming out of the Heritage Foundation, which I think Russell Vought's really connected to. And it seems like they're coming at us on all at all fronts. They're basically trying to everything that they see as a base, an institutional base for opposition, whether it's the federal civil service or universities or law firms. And now increasingly it looks like they're coming after, or they're not, it doesn't look like it. They are increasingly coming after civil society, like the nonprofit industrial complex and foundations and things like that. And this is not unique. There's unique aspects for the US with this, but it's not necessarily a unique US playbook.
Absolutely not. And the reason we use this term, authoritarian playbook, is because we can look at history and see what would-be autocrats have done. Whether they, everything you've mentioned, right? From direct investigations against their critics to giving license to lawbreaking, like January 6th immediately comes to mind, or all kinds of regulatory retaliation. And one of the reasons U.S. Agency for International Development was one of the first agencies to be cut by DOGE was because they had active lawsuits against some of the things that Elon Musk was trying to do, right? To prevent some of the things that he was trying to do. Federal law enforcement overreach from in a democratic situation is used to extend the power of the state. And then this is a tool of the authoritarian. They want to be authoritarian. And of course, deploying the military domestically is another clear indication that there is an attempt at a coup or a takeover. And it's very clear right now that the work on around with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, is about more than just kicking people out of the country or othering folks, which is also a key factor in a lot of authoritarian takeovers, if you will, making sure that they can build this police force that could operate nationally against its own citizens, basically. And so that is an active component of what we're facing right here, right now. And really, one of the pieces of work that I do with the Freedom Trainers crew is to help people understand this authoritarian playbook. I find that there's still a large number of people all across the US who, for one reason or another, they're privileged, they're where they live, their connections, their who knows what it is, have refused to acknowledge or are reluctant to acknowledge that this is where we are, that we're in the consolidation phase of an authoritarian regime. But in order to avoid that conversation or to get them to move, you can just say, have you seen any of these things happening? Have you seen the military deployed domestically? Have you seen federal law enforcement overreach? Have you seen anyone say they won't leave elected office when their time is up? Have you seen any regulatory retaliation? Is there like all these things? And they're really clear examples. Pretty much anyone who's not living under a rock has examples of some of these things and can then understand what we're talking about in context of the country right now. And this is really important because understanding this piece of political education then allows us to ask a question about what is our playbook? How do we, the people, those of us who think we should live in a more equitable, just, healthy society, whatever word you want to use, or a place that takes better care of all of us or more of us, how do we then struggle against this or bring back our capacity to govern in a way that will give us a better future? And that is a good question. And then we can move from there about how it's necessary to have a united front, a united opposition, if you will, a team left, a team democracy. I don't really care what people call it, whatever works in your circumstance, but that's something that we're working on by doing the education around this and helping people understand what we need to do to fight back, which is move from just protest and persuasion, typical marches and rallies, to more disruptive non-compliance or non-cooperation techniques like strikes, economic boycotts, jury nullification, counter-recruitment, and all of the forms of mutual aid and alternative support institutions that we need.
And we're starting to see signs of that. Like I remember, it's less what's going on in LA is like less in the news than it was when Trump first sent in the National Guard, sent in ICE, National Guard, and Marines, which also seems to be the sort of sequence in which they're doing things. But you heard a lot, particularly a lot about morale being pretty low with National Guard units, morale being pretty low even with the Marines that were in there. And I'm wondering, are we starting to see, like that's anecdotal, but are we starting to see signs of some of these signs of disruptions internally to their sort of machinations?
I hope so. And we do have some examples of this. Of course, when a regime is on its last leg, so to speak, or on its way out, we get what we call defections, or we see cracks in the pillars of support for the status quo. We see cracks in support. There's a tool that we use called Pillars of Power and Support to look at what upholds the regime, whether it's the educational institutions, whether it's our judicial institutions, the corporate institutions, the courts, religious institutions. All these things can contribute to upholding the status quo, or in this case, the rising authoritarian and the regime. And we also can see if we start winning, or when we move people away from their positions in those pillars, that we see defections in the best terms, if we can, from people like in the armed forces or in ICE or in things, National Guard. There's interesting stories when we think we've learned a lot from history. And you look at, for example, what happened when the Serbs were trying to get rid of their dictator Milosevic, and they had actually voted him out, and he was refusing to see it. And everyone was gathered outside the parliament, and he gave an order to the national, to the not their na their National Guard, but their military at the time, to fire on the assembled crowd. And they refused to fire on the crowd, thereby setting the stage for the reclaiming of the government and Milosevic being the dictator being deposed. And they refused to fire on the crowd, not only because it's a smaller country than us, but because they recognized themselves in the crowd. They knew their family, their friends, their neighbors were in the crowd. The activists had made it pretty clear that there would be a future where everyone would be welcomed, and the future would be a better future than what was happening under this brutal dictatorship of Milosevic. And so that's the extreme form of it, but we're looking for people to defect from their positions of support for the regime. And one of the things also, they bring in National Guard, they bring in military from outside of a state, for example, because those of us who are in the National Guard deployed in our own states or in our own communities, then know the people in the crowd, and we're much less likely to have mass atrocities in that case.
And one other interesting piece, I think I heard a different interview with one of your comrades, D Daniel Hunter, who was actually talking about incompetence, which actually seems to be a sort of trademark within the Trump administration. And we trade, or Trump, not we, Trump is trading loyalty for competence for loyalty, right? And so we see a lot of incompetence as well, correct?
There's an interesting thing. One thing that we do say, and we have a great crew of folks who work with us. We've done tons of training of trainers. There's one happening right now in New Orleans, in fact, because it's really important that people spread the information and trusted messengers get to talk to other folks who will listen to them. But what we, well, there's a couple things to say about this. One is that the regime will mess up. No matter what, dictatorships don't last forever. And they mess up by overreach. They mess up by extreme repression that you often can backfire and bring people more to the side of those who want change. And also, like we do also a lot of work, I do personally, also having had a short federal career with an agent with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency years ago. One of the pieces of work very early on that I got involved in the first Trump administration, and then, of course, now, was to help support civil servants and federal workers understand their role, military included, in supporting a regime or helping to undermine the regime. And there's a lot that goes on that is not public. People will be using their positions to stop harm whenever they can. They will also, as we also like to say, it's easy to fire people for insubordination, but really difficult to fire people for incompetence. And so this is also malicious compliance or following the letter of the law to the nth degree so that you can slow down the authoritarian playbook wherever it is obvious in the world that you inhabit. Particularly as civil servants or military, National Guard, this is a really fertile place to think about how you can actually support a better future.
And what, the other thing we've been seeing here is we've been seeing these brand damage corporate campaigns. I'm thinking around Tesla and Palantir. And so I'm wondering what you think and how this fits in the sort of into the non-cooperation playbook or the anti-authoritarian playbook or however y'all are, I don't know how y'all are describing it, but how is it some of these anti-corporate campaigns fitting in with that? Because I think from some of y'all's material is that there's protest, which is like less effective, but then what we need to get into more is like disruption, which is what I'm taking from what I've read and what I've heard you say in other venues, and then also from this conversation.
There's so much in this. Where do I start? So
We're
the
going to
other
go for a
thing.
long time and talk for a while today.
We have, so let's just stick with the pillars of power understanding. So if you imagine that the regime is the roof or the upper floors of a building, and the pillars are the institutions that's supporting the regime. And as I mentioned, it could be anything from faith institutions to the military, right? All the pillars are not the same. It is really clear that all pillars don't support the regime to the same degree. So pulling away, let's say, the educational system may not bring down the regime. But if we pull down the transportation industry or some specific corporations or the military, the regime would not be able to function, right? So let's be really clear that they're not all made equal, they're not all the same size, they all do different things, which means that when we do an assessment of what we want to work on campaign-wise, strategically, we think about what we call the spectrum of allies and opponents, about who these pillars are actually three-dimensional. The building is three-dimensional. The pillars are made up of people. And you might think of like the CEO or the general of the army in the center of the core of one of the pillars. Like if it was a military pillar, the general might be in there, and then other off uniformed officers, and then there would be the enlisted people, and then the enlisted people would be the families of the military folks, and then onward and onward. And so you can see that. In the we when we do a strategic analysis of who we can reach and how we can have impact on a certain pillar, need to understand who we have connections to and what the right messaging might be for moving those people. And what we find is that disruption, for example, or noncompliance, economic noncompliance, or blockading a shipment of arms or something specific can be very important in actually stopping and harm from happening, or limiting impact, or forcing the system to change in the form of an economic boycott, if it's connected appropriately, if the boycott is planned well, if the demands are really clear, if there's a negotiating committee, if there are real repercussions. A lot of ifs here, right? It takes a lot of organization. Same thing for a strike, right? Really powerful. When we look at history, a lot of regimes and governments have been brought down by strikes, ongoing strikes, general strikes, which are strikes across different sectors. In the United States, we've never had a general strike across the United States. We have had impactful, but not always strikes that have delivered full wins in places like Seattle in 1919 or Flint, Michigan in 37. We haven't had anything in my lifetime on the level with that here, and we don't really have people alive who've coordinated these mass general strikes in the United States. And so that requires a lot of prep and planning, a lot of support structures to go in place. Mutual aid is a form of that, whether it's providing people with ways to eat or ways to get education or medical services. If we're on strike, if a strike really happened, there's a lot of support that would structure that would have to go into it to start. And if we're talking about corporate campaigns like Tesla, which had a great impact on the reduction of Tesla's profits in a short amount of time, and one could argue forced Elon Musk out of the government in Washington,
Oh, Doge, yeah.
out of Doge. But the impacts of this and the system of the regime are continuing on. And so there, I like to think of it as two checkboxes of things that we need to do. One is, when we think of our strategic work, whether it's on Tesla, Palantir, any of these things, we're going to labor, like supporting labor unions, we're going to figure out what would make a good campaign strategy for us and figure out what our strengths and our weaknesses are internally and match them with our threats and opportunities external to make a good campaign plan. And then we are also going to make sure, we need to make sure in this moment to check the second box. And that is the box of whether or not this campaign plan actually not just limits harm and advances our campaign work, but also advances our capacity to address the systemic failures, to address bringing down the authoritarian, increasing our capacity to govern ourselves in the future. And if we can't do both those things, I'm going to argue we're smart enough to do both those things, then we actually need to go back to the drawing board. And I think we can do that. And I think that's really an important piece. Now, just one more thing about the spectrum of allies, which I mentioned, which is another tool that we use to think about everybody from the active allies working in this case for a resurgent democracy. We know we're not going back, but something that is better and more equitable for all of us, versus if you keep moving along the spectrum from those of us who are extremely active to those of us who agree but are passive, to the people in the middle who aren't really paying attention for a variety of reasons, to the opponents, right, who are against us philosophically or on purpose in reality, and those who are taking extreme action against those of us who want a more democratic process, like Trump or Peter Thiel or Vote or any of these folks. And we recognize that we don't have enough time or money or energy to move those people who are extreme active opposition. We might yell at them and protest at their places and do things to expose that. But what we have to realize is that we don't need them to win. We don't need everybody to win. In fact, some folks will argue or base their thoughts on some studies that show it could be as low as 3.5% of the population in sustained engagement that is what we need to win. But whatever the number is, the trick is we don't need everybody. And what we need to do with these extreme opposition folks is isolate them from the rest of us. We need to make them look ridiculous, harmful, foolish. We need to undermine them and isolate them so that we can shift people just a little closer to the side of a progressive and healthy future. And so that's how we think about it. And those campaigns, those active campaigns, in my mind, need to be thought about it in that way. Everybody, it's not like we're going to stop doing our ICE work or our immigration work or LGBTQ work or our Palestine work or any of that. It's not what I'm saying. It's that we can do both at the same time with a really clear understanding of what's going to move a particular campaign and stop harms as best we can, and also build our capacity to come together and build this united front or whatever we want to call it so that we can move beyond this authoritarian regime.
Yeah, I think it's with the spectrum of allies, I think it's important to note is that we're trying to move people who are maybe neutral on this or who agree with us but aren't doing anything. It's a classic exercise that was used during Freedom Summer in the during the civil rights movement and things like that.
Absolutely. And to figure out how to get folks personally engaged. You and I both spend a lot of time in the climate movement doing work. And the whole thing about climate chaos or is that lots of people were able until very recently to say, we don't believe it. It's not impacting me directly. And as more and more fires and floods and storms happen, more and more people are experiencing directly. And if we can do our work as activist communicators, then people understand that this is a bigger picture problem. And then they engage with us in a more direct way.
One thing I'm curious about is you've been traveling around, giving these presentations, doing trainings on this particular subject, and I'm wondering how it's resonating with the people that you're training. I for full disclosure, I went to Nadine's training about a month ago in Berkeley, but I know you've been traveling a lot doing this training.
Yeah, absolutely. And people are always saying this won't read in a rural place. This is or this won't read in an urban place or this is not for such and such or blah blah blah. Let me just tell you that like this political ed on the authoritarian playbook and helping people to understand that yeah, protest and persuasion is important, but it won't be sufficient to bring down the system. We need to go to more involved and more targeted, disruptive, non-compliant activities, non-cooperation activities, build up our people power. Everyone is receptive to this. People have, you can literally see like light bulbs going off in people's minds about where they are and what they've been facing. It's a classic, it's a hardship to grievance, classic organizing moment where people understand that the cost of living has gone up. They understand they're under attack for one reason or another. They think it's just them. And when you help them connect it to the bigger picture, they understand it as a collective grievance. And there's a name and a reason for it. And there are particular requests that you can put in, the changes that you can demand. And whether it's West Virginia, and people maybe use slightly different words, or that might take a little, you might have a little more time in one section or another of talking about it. But generally, we open up the sessions with a little tool called a spectrogram or a sociogram, where we ask people to put their bodies on a line to say whether they agree or disagree with the statement. We've experienced authoritarianism in the US before, is one of the statements that we might use. And without a doubt, there's often a spectrum in the room, but it is mostly clear to people that we are the American exceptionalism, that we've never been here before, or that it's really different. And people are over that. They know, like whether it's from West Virginia, where like the entire room was like, of course we've seen it before. We might not call it authoritarianism, but we know the state was never on our side. We're still dying of black lung disease here because the state was interested in profit rather than our lives. Or you can go to Berkeley, where pretty much everybody was like, yeah, we've seen internment camps. This is from the Japanese internment camps in World War II. People were really clear and make their personal connections to it.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how these trainings and this education really opens people up. Because I find the other thing is that this is not the stuff that they teach us in school, right? This, and increasingly, this is also what Trump is trying to purge from public education and university education as well.
Yeah.
One other, and I also thinking about West Virginia. I actually just read a book on Kent State, which just has me thinking about how Kent State is this place where there was this terrible repression, including the National Guard shooting and killing four people, or shot more than that, but killed four people. And the parallels, the book was a little bit written with parallels for today, but it was like just the parallels of the overreach that happened in 1970 from the Nixon administration on down.
Yeah. Well,
It was scary more than anything, but yeah.
there's a lot. I have some close friends who were at Kent State at the time at the shootings, and I have some close friends who lived through the Holocaust, even some elders in my life, and people are rightfully really distraught. I will say there's a lot of work also that I'm involved with on making repression, making political violence and threats of violence backfire. And there's some great resources. FreedomTrainers.net has great resources if people have not been on that site about everything I've been talking about, slideshows and all kinds of things. And then the endpoliticalviolence.org, which is a group called Harnessing Our Power to End Political Violence, has resources on the theory of backfire and making the repression of an authoritarian would-be regime or others backfire by being prepared and ready to redeem the folks who are the brunt of the violence, being ready to make sure that people know that they will be intimidated or they might be bribed, making sure that there are trusted community members out ready to speak in support of the ICE agent, the community members that have been seized by ICE, et cetera. This is also really an important part of the work that we do as activists, getting prepared to make political violence backfire so that we can continue to build our numbers and our capacity to respond.
I'm wondering how y'all, I would say we have this week in the news, we have two cities, which are, there's two very different approaches that I'm seeing between Chicago and Portland. And so in Chicago, you see a lot of pushback. There's like big marches. You see a lot of community leaders who are not just rabble-rouser activists, but like ministers and migrant rights leaders and the governor of Illinois. And there's like a serious fight vibe coming out of there. But then you also have Portland, where their response, like Trump has called Portland war-ravaged Portland and says it's a war zone and things like that. The response has been where they dress up like funny inflatable animals and just mock them. And I never hear more about more than a protest at the ICE facility in Portland of more than 100 people. And so it's very much not the narrative that the administration's starting to put out. And I'm wondering how y'all and Freedom Trainers are looking at these two different situations.
Yeah, I mean, we were involved in training folks in all these places before the response happened because it was pretty clear that it was on the way. And one of the things that we've really encouraged people to do and support people in doing is continue to do trainings and support and to form spokes councils or platforms of communication and coordination between all of the groups and things that are on the ground already doing this work. So whether you're labor unions, whether you're NGOs, non-governmental org agencies or activist groups or legal teams or faith communities, helping people to talk to each other about communication and coordination about action and getting to the point where we can work together and do collective action. Right now, we don't have a nationalized response that makes sense in my mind, but we do have local platforms or communities that are responding in coordinated fashions, building their capacity to get to a point where we can do something collective at a national level. So, Free DC is one of the big things that I'm involved in support. And yes, there are slightly different responses. And we just also part of it is if you depends which media you listen to, right? Because there have been elected officials in Oregon as well who've been very clear about the attacks on the communities in the state being a being something that they can write proclamations about and declarations about. So I think it is also really important And I was just in another community, like Salt Lake City, for example, where it's important for us to think about what are the pieces and the culture that we can build on where we are to make sure that this works. And Free DC, for example, building on our call for DC statehood, which is a unique position as an occupied territory in the US, rather than because we don't have a lot of the same regulations or laws that, say, Chicago or Portland has. But it is really important. Like, Portland is a great example of harnessing the Portland is weird vibe and going for broke on humor and undermining the ridiculous nature of what Trump is saying is happening there, which is all false. In fact, they've also been caught trying to bait and trap protesters into responding so that they can use the images to reinforce the false claims of the administration. So people who,
Hand-to-hand combat with Antifa is how Stephen Miller described it in Portland. It's crazy.
it's really not okay. Yeah, it's not
Yep.
based in reality. But a lot of what is said coming out of the White House these days is not based in reality. So this is a typical authoritarian playbook, just making up full-fledged stories about what's going on, and part of our job is to make sure that they're ridiculed for it and they are that there's a viable opposition. In DC, for example, we are really clear, and we know from history that the authoritarians really want to dominate and control the capital cities because that supports their narrative. And it's important for us to make sure that doesn't happen, that there's a viable, public, visible opposition in the capital city. It means more than that. We're resisting there. It means that people can see there are viable pockets of opposition everywhere, and in particular in the urban capital district, they do not have control. And I think it's really valuable that it looks, we're in a huge country. This is also something that's really different than the United States. We have very different regional and localized cultures that we need to take into account when we plan and execute our movement for a better world.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got one other question, and then I'll ask you to also just talk about Freedom Trainers a little bit. But what kind of action are you encouraging people to take right now? What's your vision for how we move?
Yeah, there are a lot of things written about civil resistance, people power, whatever frame you want to use, nonviolent action. We are really calling on people to be strategic. So we don't promote, in the real sense, nonviolence as a way of life or a philosophical way of being. That's great. We support it. And also, what we're calling on people to do is engage in strategic nonviolent action. And this is a concerted effort where regular people together can wield their power to make change without threats of violence or using force or using weapons. And we do this by, particularly like in Free DC and other places, emphasizing joy and community celebration and coming together and community of building as a whole. And it starts often with people showing up for a No Kings protest or an Indivisible March or rally. Those things are important because, again, it visibilizes an opposition that what's happening is not okay. And it becomes valuable when we onboard people into organizations and groups so that they can then be supported in taking the next steps, which are more meaningful, disruptive activities like. And we focus a lot right now of exploring eight particular kinds of non-cooperation. And the eight particular kinds of non-cooperation, we mentioned a few of them already. The
Right.
obvious ones like economic boycotts, labor strikes. One that doesn't get a lot of talk about is tax resistance. But if we're not happy with a system, we should think about withdrawing our support for that system financially. And there's legal and illegal ways to do this. There are ways that individuals can do it, of course, W-2 and withholding. And there are ways that labor unions can think about how they remove their money from pension funds if those monies are invested in Palantir or Tesla or orgs or groups that are supporting the regime, right? So there's a lot of ways to think about that. Then there's jury nullification, which encourages people to use their right to serve on a jury as long as we have them and make sure that they understand their responsibility and their potential for basically using their conscience and using their political understanding of the moment we're in and not finding people guilty even if they've done the crime, because they understand the whole damn system is guilty. For example, and these are tried and true American traditions, right? Tax resistance is as old as the British resistance to the British when the country formed. And things like jury nullification, at the end of the slavery period in the United States, there was a law that tried to prosecute people who were enabling people who were formerly enslaved to escape slavery. And some folks who sat on those juries knew that, in fact, people were helping folks escape slavery, and they knew they were guilty of that, guilty that they were doing it, but they refused to indict people for this because they knew the whole institution of enslaving others was morally corrupt and unjust. And so this is a longstanding tradition. We saw it recently with the sandwich guy who
The
nobody,
DC sandwich guy, yeah.
this is Mr. Subway, who was not indicted in a grand jury, I think six, seven times, because people were like, this is ridiculous. And it goes on from there. And then, of course, we also talk about social non-cooperation, refusing to do things culturally or using sports events or in other celebrations to show resistance. And like in DC and in other places, at the 51st minute of some sports games, we chant Free DC to be the 51st state. That's what the connection is. And we also have things like, and we have a whole bunch of things coming up that might fall in under this that people might be interested in, the Super Bowl and the World Cup, and all these things are coming to the US. Okay. And then there's another big piece of what we call counter recruitment or fraternizing with the opposition, having a real active pull for people away from these pillars that support the regime. And some of this work is very undercover so that it can continue. And some of it is better done with a carrot than a stick. So it's not necessarily disruption as in a blockade or a boycott, but rather making sure that people know in ICE or the National Guard or the law or the military that there's a place for them in our future, that the future will be more joyous and more appropriate, that they'll have better health care and better working conditions, and it will be a better place in general. So there's lots of different ways of going about this. Another one is that undermines a lot of this work is building these alternative institutions and structures. We're going to need legal support. We're going to need monetary support. We're going to need food banks. We're going to need possibly alternative schooling. We're going to need alternative environmental protection agency. All these things, shadow governments, things like this, all fall into this big category that is both potentially non-cooperation and also supporting these other things to happen. And then finally, another one that is really worth talking about, and we mentioned it briefly already, was the civil service or internal workers in the regime kind of work so that we can resist harms and limit harms and make it more possible that we can have some kind of return to a democracy or a government that we all participate in. So that's some of the work that we're trying to do and helping people think about what it looks like in real terms to do that work.
And if people know, being that I went to your training last month, that's a large gist of what the training is. So if people want to get involved, go to a training, host a training, learn to be a trainer, things like that, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, I would say just go to the freedomtrainers.net website is a place to do it. There's an email there, team at or info at freedomtrainers.net. It will come to us. There's also a way to on that website to request a training, I believe, and or we can hook you up with people who've been trained because I think at this point we've trained like 500,000 people. And a lot of those folks, not all of them, but a lot of them are trained as trainers, have done a lot of this work or parts of this work previously and are ready to go in their communities and are doing trainings in their communities. We really encourage people to get connected there. I'll just also give a pitch. There's a lot of great information in it within another group that I work with, beautifultrouble.org, and that website is available in, I don't know, half a dozen, nine languages, depending upon what you look at. And there are tools for facilitators and trainers, say how to use the Pillars of Power tool, how to use the Spectrum of Allies tool, how to do strategic thinking and analysis, and how to be more creative and innovative in the actions that you do take on. So I really encourage people to visit that website as well.
All right. I'm gonna wrap it there. Folks, we've been talking with Nadine Block, activist, artist, strategic trainer, and organizer. Definitely check out Freedom Trainers and Beautiful Trouble. Big fan of both. If you like what you're hearing, please check Green and Red Podcast out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. And then if you're listening to us on one of the many audio platforms we're on, give us a rate and review. And then if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Nadine, it's great talking with you. And for everyone else out there, make trouble and misbehave. And we'll talk to you again soon.